Even from the outside, the inn looked a pleasant house to familiar eyes. It had a front on the road and two wings running back on land partly cut out of the lower slopes of the hill, so that at the rear of the second floor windows were level with the ground. There was a wide arch leading to a courtyard beyond the two wings, and on the left under the arch there was a large doorway reached by a few broad steps. The door was open, and light streamed out of it. Above the arch there was a lamp, and beneath it swung a large signboard. A fat white pony reared up on its hind legs. Over the door was painted in white letters, "The Prancing Pony" by Barlum and Butterbur. Today the Grey Company resumes the book club, venturing into chapters 9 and 10 of Book 1. We'll meet Barlum and Butterbur and Strider, discuss how well the game adapted these stories, share some custom cards, and generally wish that there was a merry old inn for us to share a pint in.
It is episode 42 of the Grey Company podcast. My name is Derek, and today on the show, it's time to get back to the book, the source material, the tome itself. If you didn't take the cue from the intro, turn your copy of The Lord of the Rings to Book 1, Chapter 9, and tuck in. While you're doing so, let's check in with the rest of the gang. Albeit truncated again, we will miss Matthew tonight. But how are the rest of you dudes? Dan, let's start with you. How have you been these last few weeks since we recorded?
I have been well. I have been basking in the glory that is the first two APs of this cycle. Cool. I really, really dig it.
I thought you were going to say basking in the glory of Austin in summertime, but I don't think bask is the right word.
I don't think bask is the right word. Yeah, it's the humidity, the temperature's rising, the rain has stopped, the humidity's starting to get up there. It's, I don't know.
Maybe wallowing?
sunning myself like a lizard, perhaps? I don't know. Yeah, I don't think basking is quite
Yeah, not quite. So what do you...
How's Atlanta for you?
Oh, sorry.
No, I was just wondering if Atlanta is likewise, or if you're surviving out there.
It's been this week. This has been the week when I can feel in my bones the electric bill going up as we've had the AC running nonstop. But we're escaping to the beach this week, so it should be a little cooler. But yeah, Atlanta's no fun. If Austin is Mordor, then Atlanta, Georgia is the Brownlands.
Oh, wow. Brutal.
Something like that. But what have you liked the most about? We spent some time talking about Stormcaller. What do you like most about The Thing in the Depths?
I said this probably when I described the
just
first
don't say
pack,
Kraken.
No. It's so thematically perfect. Mm-hmm. Like they're really hitting their stride in terms of marrying the mechanics of the quest, but having them feel like it really does feel like these tentacles are wrapped around parts of the ship, and then you need to you can't let them get too much of it, or they're gonna rip it apart. Mm-hmm. Like it's such a fun quest. Yeah,
that's cool. Ian, how have you been, sir?
I'm good. I guess if you guys are in the Brownlands and Mordor, respectively, then the SF Bay Area is the Shire, maybe?
Don't you say that. Don't you say that with your cheap sunshine and your tans. I'll think about a good analogous location in Middle Earth while you talk about what you've been up to lately.
So pretty similar to Dan, just really enjoying the first two packs. I said already the Grey Havens was my favorite deluxe expansion so far, and I would not be surprised at all if this ends up being my favorite cycle by the end of it, just based on these first two packs. I do really enjoy this new one. It's kind of like a refined Watcher in the Water, kind of removing some of the more annoying random elements of the tentacles in that quest, and this one is just really consistent, really fun, really tight. I love the moment where the two people you're fighting, Sahir and Nasia, kind of join forces with you.
Yeah,
kind
cool.
of, you know, take a moment, give them a little fist bump, and you're like, let's do this.
The narrative on that, kudos, because I have a feeling that Matt probably wrote that. The narrative is perfect, because it's like, the way it describes it on the quest card is you take a look at this giant monster and you all silently agree, okay, we're not fighting each other anymore.
Batter fish to fry. Borg are coming.
Yep.
Exactly.
And ally Sam Gamgee isn't bad to have around either. All right, well, I'm going to go with Southern California. The Bay Area is Breeland, if only because it is so appropriate to what we're about to talk about. So the chapters we're discussing today are At the Sign of the Prancing Pony and Strider, all of which revolve around, get this, the Prancing Pony and the Breeland. Prior to this, the last book club, we had spent some time with Tom Bombadil and discussed the wonderful mystery that he is. We escaped the clutches of the Barrow-wights and were sent on our way down the great east-west road by Tom himself. And this chapter, chapter 9, opens with a long description of the Men of Bree. Now, being a fantasy nerd, being a bit of a history nerd, being just a Tolkien geek in general, I love these bits of exposition. A lot of readers can get bogged down by this stuff, but once you get into the world, this bit of exposition in particular about the Men of Bree is just so rich, especially when you start nerding out and you do, I don't know, a blog like Master of Lore. Having these explanations is huge, but we'll get into that in a second. I'll give us all a quick summary before we do that. So after a bit of exposition about the Bree land itself and the Inn of Bree, the Prancing Pony, the hobbits pull up to the door, and they make for the inn. And we learn a little bit about Barlaam and Butterbur. We learn about some things going on in Bree. We know that there's some shady stuff happening. And poor old Mr. Frodo, in getting a little too comfortable and trying to distract some of their newfound Bree Hobbit friends, slips, and the ring somehow lands on his finger. We don't know how. We do. And then he finds himself next to a very shady-looking gentleman named Strider. They talk a little bit. And then at the end of the evening, Mr. Underhill retires to his room. And we'll talk about Strider when we get to it. So where do you guys want to start? What do you want to talk about first? What's your favorite parts of this chapter?
One thing that, I really enjoyed going back and reading it again, is it's subtle, but I really like the way Strider, you get a sense of the history of him.
Mm.
He talks about the Black Riders as though he's had encounters with them before, and they don't go into any details, and it's just kind of thrown out there. And because the Hobbits, you know, because your perspective as the reader, at least the first time through the books, is very much from the Hobbits' perspective, it doesn't necessarily have the weight, but having read the book so many times now going back, that was the thing that kind of struck me as I read it again, is that, wow, like, Aragorn has dealt with the Black Riders. That's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. It really is.
I'm probably going to say this for every book club we do, which is these are some of my favorite chapters of the book. So I'll probably end up saying that over and over again. But these really have been kind of chapters that have always stuck out in my mind just because of this idea of, you know, coming to this place, the Prancing Pony. And this is kind of the one time in Tolkien that you get this kind of just a regular, like, small town, you know,
yeah.
Not like a big Minas Tirith or even an Edoras or something like that. This is just like common folk town, an inn, you know, this is what people do. And that's the aspect I like. And in a lot of ways, I feel like this one scene chapter is kind of, innocuous as it seems, has been really influential. I mean, the whole, like, idea of like a fantasy story or an RPG campaign starting in an inn, like, is heavily influenced by that. I mean, even
Barlaam
even
is like the archetype for every, you know, fat, sweaty barkeep that you like, read in every single fantasy novel.
Totally. Even like Star Wars, the cantina scene. I mean, this is like the cantina scene for Middle Earth. He talks about dwarves being there,
right?
And, you know, southerners and just all kinds of people. So, yeah, but it just. It has importance beyond just what it is for the story, I think, just in its kind of influence on culture, I guess.
I agree, and I also think that in terms of the narrative itself, it seems to me in the times I've read over this and all the other things that Tolkien wrote, this is almost like, in my mind, a transition from the, I'm not lighthearted, but the more fanciful and less historical Hobbit, Shire, Tom Bombadil, Barrow-wights, into the more historical, because there's plenty of supernatural and magical elements that we come across from this point in the story on, but it loses that fanciful tone and it takes on a slightly more historical tone. Like, people have said The Lord of the Rings has a darker tone than The Hobbit. I don't agree with that. I think it has a more of a more grown up or a more historical tone. And I think this is where in the within the story of The Lord of the Rings, this is where that tone is kind of taken on, as opposed to all the Hobbit silliness and then the the seeming randomness of Tom Bombadil. Yeah,
that's one of the things about Tolkien that I actually like, is that even in The Hobbit itself, but also, like you just said, in The Lord of the Rings, his tone changes from the beginning to the end as it goes on, you know, starting kind of more in this fanciful, you know, hobbits, and it starts growing into this grand, like, you know, kind of saga, mythical type thing. And even in The Hobbit, it starts very, you know, whimsical, and by the end, you kind of have this almost like Greek tragedy with Thorin. And, you know, in a way that seems strange, because a lot of writers are told, keep a consistent tone throughout your books, right? And Tolkien doesn't do that. Part of it because kind of his ideas change as he's writing, but also he's taking the reader on a journey by doing that as well. Like, as the characters are kind of experiencing a change in the tone of their lives, I guess you could say, his writing tone also changes, and I think that's really cool.
Absolutely. Going back to the beginning, where I mentioned the exposition about Bri, I like that it, kind of like I said before, it begins to connect us to the wider world of Middle-earth. We get that in The Hobbit, but that story is specifically about the dwarves and Bilbo. And this already starts to show us what the world outside the Shire and outside of Hobbit lore is like. So it talks about how, the phrase "strange is news from Bri," like that was that's the New York City of their area, even though it's this tiny town. And the fact that we see, as you said, dwarves and elves going back and forth. And I think that the only mention that Bri gets in The Hobbit is where it's like a line in that second chapter where they said it's like on the fifth day they passed a town where men sang strange songs. And that's the only town that could be is Bri, but that's all we get about it. Mm. And so now we're getting a little bit more about what it's like. And not only that, but we learned that the hobbits of the Shire are not the only hobbits. And I always crack up when I get into... I love anything like of the Hobbit silliness. I think it's so entertaining. But then when the hobbits at the inn are so taken with the Shire hobbits because Frodo lies and says he's writing a book of genealogy and he thinks he might have some connections, and everyone is like, their mind is just blown, and they just spend the rest of the evening like talking his ear off about their relations. I just crack up every time I read that.
Until they realize that he's not actually going to write the book on the spot. And right. Then they promptly lose interest, right?
That's the exact line, isn't it? Like, when they had no, you know, he's not going to write the book right now.
Yeah, he found himself alone, I think is what he says. But yeah, it's a pretty humorous chapter, all told. There's one other thing, I think, as far as the narrative arc that's kind of important with this, is that this is the first time we see that it's not just the Shire that has been changing in recent times. This is their first time really outside of the borders. I mean, obviously the Old Forest is nominally outside the borders, but it's still... It kind of feels like until they leave Bombadil that they're still kind of, they have some kind of sense of safety, and now they're entering the world at large, so to speak. And you get the sense from Barlaman and from some of the other things that are said throughout these chapters that, oh, like, there's been people coming up from the south, and, you know, there's unrest. They talk about the Brelanders being uneasy about these ideas, you know, this mass immigration, and, you know, there's things going on that, are implications of broader things in Middle-earth happening.
Absolutely.
And you realize that it's not just the Shire where things have gotten strange in recent times.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this chapter is I feel like it's one of the chapters in the book that whenever I read it, I end up getting something new out of it each time I read it, and not all the chapters are like that. I like that there's that sense of kind of connectedness with the rest of the world. One of the things that always stuck out to me about Middle-earth compared to a lot of other fantasy worlds is, in some ways, it feels kind of very isolated and depopulated, especially the north. And in most fantasy worlds, you kind of get the sense that there's just all these crazy people everywhere.
Right.
And I, you know, it's kind of, I think, part of Tolkien's whole thing of, like, you know, the fading during the Third Age, mm-hmm. and just that whole theme. But, the Bree section is kind of the exception to that, where you see kind of, it's kind of like this island in the midst of a right. wilderness in a lot of ways, even more so than the Shire. Because the Shire feels like it's just kind of its own universe. But this is kind of like its island in the middle of the storm. And I definitely like that aspect of it.
I think that's a good thing to note, because the whole journey of the Fellowship, really until they get to Rohan, and even when they're in Rohan, is a lot of it is just their journey. And there's no one else around.
Yeah.
And they get a little creeped out when there's even an animal around that's looking at them. So I like that sense of openness that the book provides. Go on a slight tangent. I dabble with the Lord of the Rings online game. I used to play it addictively, but we started dabbling with it a little bit. And as beautifully as they have rendered the world of Middle Earth in that game, the weird thing is that there are towns everywhere and there are settlements everywhere, and that's just a mechanical concern. You got to have right. people to give you the quest so you can go and kill 10 rats. But it's just weird being in Rohan and seeing a town within eyeshot of another town in a world that's supposed to, in specifically a part of that world that's supposed to be almost empty. So all that's to say that I do like that aspect of Middle Earth, a quality of the land, that it is very open and sparsely populated, especially in the north, like you said, Ian. And I think that's reflected in the game a bit too, especially in the north, in our last cycle. I'm thinking specifically of like the, my brain's blanking. Which is the quest where you had to like take shelter with the sheltered locations across the Edmores?
Across the Edmores?
Yeah.
I'm thinking specifically of across the Edmores, where the land is kind of against you, and you can find these refuges and take shelter there. I think that's a very cool touch.
Yeah, I guess to take almost a different look at it as far as the player side of it. Now that you're mentioning that kind of feeling that a lot of, at least the early part of the books, is just the Fellowship and no one else around. But in the game, you know, kind of what you're doing a lot of the time is mustering this big army of allies, you know, like you're basically roving around with the equivalent of like a huge party or something.
A small army.
So I'm just curious what you guys think of that. Like, how well do you think the game translates that particular part of Tolkien? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't.
I think it's the same challenge that Derek's referring to, or a similar challenge with, you know, Lord of the Rings Online, is that there's a need from a mechanics standpoint. The game would be boring if you just had, you picked your three heroes, and that's the only characters that interplay throughout an entire quest. It would just mm-hmm. not be very interesting. So you kind of have to overpopulate it to make it interesting, and it's hard to have that balance. I guess that was one difference of Middle-earth CCG, is that you kind of picked your party, and you would, like, recruit allies throughout the game as sort of, like, victory points or whatever. But the game felt maybe a little bit more sparse with that one, whereas this tends to have, right. a lot of decks have kind of the ally explosion, where you end up having 40 characters in play by the end of the quest, but...
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's been a conscientious or a conscious nod to that part of the story or that theme of the book, but there are options for having a deck that's mostly your heroes or your heroes and some big allies. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work as well because a lot of times you just need the numbers. You just need the bodies on the table, either for willpower or chump blocking or whatever. But there are options, and, you know, there have been somewhat viable decks that are just about the Voltron heroes, like we enjoy saying around here. Or I think the Secrecy deck is kind of a nod to that, too, because you can abstract it a little bit better and a little more clearly as your two heroes making their journey and they're encountering allies along the way. But that's a good thing to bring up, and I definitely agree with what Dan said about it being a mechanical concern. Like, the only way... For every Middle Earth game or Lord of the Rings or Hobbit game there's been the cadre of core Tolkien fanatics that are just going to whine about it because it's so different from the stories that they love. The only way you're going to have a perfect Lord of the Rings game is if you're Frodo or you're Aragorn, and it's and you're going through the exact events of the book. And that's just, you know, there have been games that have done that kind of, but it's I don't want to spend a week of my real time going from Bree to Rivendell. So whenever you abstract the story in that way, there's going to be some changes, and that's probably one of the bigger ones that you brought up. Mm-hmm. But let's while we're talking about the cards, let's talk about the cards for A Knife in the Dark, which was the second quest of the Black Riders box, which really covers both of these chapters. We'll go ahead and talk about it now since we're talking about the Prancing Pony. So what do we think about the cards in question? How well did they adapt this part of the story?
I feel like they do a good job. I mean, Bill Ferney is certainly a nuisance.
For sure.
You have so to build the deck around like pulling win. Him out of the staging area, don't you? That makes him a real pain.
Yeah, definitely. I think the whole... Overall, I really still really love this quest, and the reason why is it was hard... I think it's a hard design job to encapsulate both this part of it, which is kind of the Bree hiding from these spies, and then the later part where you're facing down the Nazgul, which we'll be talking about next book club. But the whole mechanic of basically... what a lot of these spies are doing, including Bill Ferney, is they either do something bad to you or they shuffle one of these Ringwraiths into the encounter deck, which basically represents, unless you are kind of proactively trying to deal with these spies, they are going to be, you know, giving information about you to the Ringwraith, and that's going to make your job harder later on as more of the nine are going to be able to find you. And that whole idea is really cool, and I think... really does tie in well what's happening with this chapter. I feel like this is one of the few chapters, unless I'm just totally blanking on stuff later on in the books, where it's really dealing with this idea of men spying for Sauron, which is really fascinating if you think about it. I mean, you see men servants of him later on, but this whole idea of just random, you know, Bill Ferney's just a random dude in Bree. Like, what brought him to the point he's spying for, you know, the enemy? Kind of interesting to think about.
Yeah,
I agree. And getting away from the spy thing and looking at the actual Prancing Pony itself, I think you had to have it in there, and that's where you start with this particular quest. And I like that it gave you the ability of... I like that it gives you the response of being able to put an ally into play from your hand. To me, it's, yes. You could say that it's specifically representative of meeting Strider, but it also goes back to what we were saying before about Bree being this gathering place of all the people. So I think that's cool that you get a little boost in addition to the nasties. I don't know. My gripe is that the card art is too dark. I think Peter Jackson scene where they're coming upon Bree and they're marching through the streets and it's rainy and dark and everyone's looking kind of gnarly. It creates a sense of dread that you're supposed to empathize with the hobbits. But it influenced the look, in my opinion, a little too far. And I feel like that the art on this particular card reflects that.
Yeah, I really love that location because not only does it have the kind of bring an ally into play, because, you know, where are you going to find allies if not in an inn? But also, when you leave play, then you have to deal with enemies.
Right.
And, you know, it brings in X enemies, which is the number of players in the game. So that can be pretty hairy. I remember we played the Black Riders at Gen Con, cracked it open, myself, Dan, and Matthew, and... I think Sam took on how many enemies because of Prancing Pony? I think he took on like all three or something crazy like that. Basically, he had a bunch because it goes to the first player. That's right. But I feel like maybe some newer players who are listening might not know the history of the game. But me personally, I feel like Black Riders is when they first started really honing in on making locations, making the decision of when to travel to a location meaningful. Instead of, let me just travel to that because, you know, I need to get it out of the staging area, or I'm never traveling to that because it's bad. The Black Riders is the first time I feel like they, you know, you have to think about it. I want that ally from the Prancing Pony, but I also don't want to have to deal with, like, two or three enemies right now. Right. So when do I travel to it?
So. Yeah, picking your poison is definitely an interesting aspect of travel. And in general, when the game gives you that balance of it does something good, but then it either then immediately does something bad or does something bad later, like, it just... It's... Yeah, there's a certain poetry to that, I guess.
Was there anything from this chapter, or I mean even Strider, since we kind of are bleeding into that now, that you wish they would have somehow included in the game that they didn't? Or was it covered as well as it could be with two chapters that are mostly dialogue and the, kind of the same scene within the pony?
I think it would be cool to see hobbits from outside of the Shire, and actually, I mean, I guess that would be a real sign that hobbits become a full-fledged faction. They're already kind of moving in that direction with the Sam
right.
ally and some of the and the Elevensies event, but it would be cool to actually see some, like, you know, what is it, Nob and Bob, and, you know, you could even make up some FFG hobbits, because it obviously it mentions at the start of the chapter that they exist, so
for sure.
Well, I think there's one big glaring omission that is just an absolute shame that they haven't included, which is beer. Beer is such a huge part of this chapter. Even Aragorn is described as having a tankard in front of him, so here's a shout out for us getting a tankard attachment in the future, I'm hoping.
Yeah, I think there might be one in the near future as we get to the custom cards. Nice. Along with Bob and Nob coming up. Let's talk about Strider for a little bit. So the Strider chapter is a direct continuation of the scene. We find out what happened to Merry, because Merry had stepped out for a sniff of air, as he says, and he has a close encounter. And before they go up to the room, they return to the parlor where they had been eating, and somebody's waiting for them. Guess what? It's Strider. And the chapter is literally... us getting to know Strider. Like Dan said before, we learn that he knows something about the Black Riders. We know that he wants to help the hobbits, but we know that he looking a little bit shiesty, and we don't know if we should trust him. And so the whole chapter is almost like a resume or job interview for Strider, as he kind of convinces Frodo and the hobbits of his good intentions. And then, of course, we get the final reference, the best reference of all, which is a letter from Gandalf the Grey that... Barleyman forgot. Barleyman got a little, I think Gandalf...
I knew there was something on my mind.
That's right. One thing drives out another. So we get the letter of reference from Gandalf, and then the hobbits agree to take on Strider, because, you know, a servant of the enemy would look fairer and feel fouler than the dirty ranger. By the way, I love that his name is Strider, because he literally just strides around because he's so tall and he has the long shanks as Barleyman describes it. And I also love that they work that into the movie where they barge in and what is Sam's like, I'll have you, long shanks. But I digress. So let's talk about this chapter. Like I said, there's not a whole lot going on in terms of action, but we learn a lot about the character of Strider and a little bit about the Black Riders as well.
Yeah, it's hard reading this chapter after you've read Lord of the Rings so many times and you know who Aragorn is and you have this idea of him in your head as this king. And so it's hard to go back in my head to how it was the first time I read the chapter and Strider was truly just this mysterious dude. And it is interesting that he does seem different than, you know, I've heard it said, and I think I've even said it myself, that Aragorn doesn't have much of a character arc in the books compared to others, you know, and at least compared to the movie. But he does seem kind of a different character almost at this point. And like I was mentioning earlier, that the Prancing Pony inspired the whole kind of inn trope, and I feel like Strider inspired the whole ranger trope in RPGs and fantasy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he was just that small, like, glimpse of this mysterious Strider character was really cool. You know, I remember thinking that as a kid, oh, this guy's so cool.
Well, just the whole look, like with the hood and the pipe. Yeah. I mean, lore Aragorn card is, you know, I want to play it most of the time just because of the art. I don't even care about the being able to reset my threat.
And I always thought it was fascinating that Tolkien kind of reversed the classic saying, which was, all that glitters is not gold. This idea of, like, you know, everything that looks nice isn't necessarily a good thing. And Tolkien reversed that to all that is gold does not glitter. And that was always kind of an interesting.
Do you think that was intentional? Because, I mean, no doubt he read Robert Frost.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I believe so. Huh. I believe that the other version is older. You know, I could be wrong on that. But,
No. Yeah, Robert Frost definitely predates Tolkien by a few years. So, no, that's interesting. I'd never thought of that. It's also worth noting that even in, you know, the quote unquote the big city of Bree, everyone still is pretty much a yokel. So, which leads me on another kind of side note. We hear about in the previous chapters that even the hobbits have heard of Mordor and Sauron, even if it's, you know, shadows on the edges of old stories. And then we hear about the Black Riders, and Strider informs us that they come from Mordor, and Butterbur almost has a panic attack. But then he says, like, you know, if you really want to help us, you could come with us and leave Bree. And he says, I wouldn't leave Bree for any money, you know. So he's still a local boy, even if this is the biggest town of the region. But it is interesting that the mention of Black Riders coming from Mordor, you know, causes Butterbur to have this outburst. I'm looking at the quote now. He says, that is the worst news that has come to Bree in my time, like these servants from Mordor. So I don't know. I have a hard time coming to grips with that because it's been a long time. You know, Mordor and Sauron have been a problem for a long time. So obviously there's time enough for news to reach Bree, but just the sheer mention of the name of Mordor to cause innkeepers to shudder thousands of leagues away. I don't know. I guess it hypes up the Black Riders a little bit more, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess yokel is a good description. Aragorn kind of has some sass in him, right? He says he calls him a fat innkeeper who only remembers his own name because people shouted at him all day. Like, dang, Aragorn, that's rude.
It's brutal. It's pretty harsh.
Aragorn is harsh. And Gandalf threatens to roast him. But then on the other hand, you look at it and Gandalf clearly is kind of spending time befriending Barlaman. You know, I noticed he called him Barley, kind of has his affectionate name for him. And it just goes to show again that Gandalf spent a lot of time befriending yokels and hobbits who don't know anything about the world and all these people who everyone else, including Aragorn, scoff at a little bit. Definitely Saruman would scoff at them. But obviously he saw some worth in those people that's who he wanted to kind of spend his time trying to build relationships with.
That's cool. That's a good observation. All right. Is it time to discuss custom cards? Because we got some good ones.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. So our first one is an Aragorn ally. It would be a Strider ally if the precedent already hadn't been set that he's always Aragorn. It's an Aragorn ally. This is was submitted by Philip Barrett. He is a 5-cost leadership ally. 2 willpower, 3 attack, 2 defense, 4 hit points. Imagine that. And his ability says travel action. Spend a leadership resource to choose a non-unique enemy in the staging area until the end of the round. That enemy gets +10 engagement cost, limit 3 times per round. So his rangerish, rangerly ability allows you to pump up the cost of the engagement cost, I should say, of an enemy, which is pretty fitting, right? Especially if he's going to be going around helping out some hobbits.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd definitely play it for sure. Yeah, especially in a hobbit deck.
Those are some pretty sweet stats for an ally.
Yeah, it's 5 costs about right. I'd say, 5 costs is about right.
Yeah.
And if you're doing this in kind of the original Tri-Sphere Hobbit deck, it's kind of a no-brainer to put him in there, especially because you'll probably have Elfstone, which will let you put him in for free. In the art spot on. That's cool. Good job. Thanks for sending us that, Philip. That's a good card. Now, we got, quite a while ago, we got a whole bunch from a gentleman by the name of Mark. And we had to wait to show them because he sent them in a little early, and he sent us a bunch. We will post them all on the show notes, so make sure you check those out. But we have a few that we must discuss since they kind of came up earlier in the show. The first being the Prancing Pony Ale. It is a one-cost spirit attachment with a very appropriate picture. One-cost spirit attachment. It is an item. It is ale, and it says, attached to a hero. Action, exhaust and discard Prancing Pony Ale to discard the top two cards of target player's deck. If the combined resource cost is even attached... If the combined resource cost is even, attached character gets plus one attack, plus one defense, plus two willpower until the end of the round. If the combined resource cost is odd, deal attached character one damage and exhaust that character. So when you start chugging ale, you take your fate into your own hands.
Seems appropriate.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I wish this was a real card. I love the kind of risk-reward cards and the idea of you getting too drunk and just going for a nap in the corner.
Yes.
You gotta sleep it off, right? Yeah.
To make it a little more playable, I'd probably make it zero cost, since you discard to use it anyway. But that's, we do need beer in this game. I think we need to have a whole sphere, or excuse me, a whole cycle centered around food and drink. We'll work on that.
Yeah, totally. You could have your tankard, and you could put your different kind of ales in there.
Old Vineyard. That's great.
I'm not sure if this would increase your willpower or decrease your willpower.
It'd increase your will to sleep.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
All right. So good job on the pony ale. Let's look at a couple other ones. He did Bob and Nob, who appropriately have the Hobbit and Bree traits. Bob is a one-cost neutral ally with no stats and one hit point. But his ability reads, if an attachment on a Hobbit hero you control would leave play, you may discard Bob from play to return that attachment to your hand. If each hero you control has the Hobbit trait, then you can play that attachment for zero cost. So that's pretty cool. I don't know that I've seen a card that directly deals with attachment discard effects, but it does so, and it does so in a thematically appropriate way, as Bob's kind of all about going around the inn fetching stuff for Barley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really cool.
Especially, this would be a great card, especially if the Hobbit trait sees some more development and we get like a Thane card or something that might give a global buff or something to Hobbit, so he might get a stat or something. This is good. I like this card a lot. And his counterpart, Nob, is a two-cost spirit ally with one willpower, zero attack, zero defense, one hit point. He is also a Hobbit Bree. Or Bree Hobbit, I should say. While you are engaged with an enemy with a higher engagement cost than your threat, Nob gains. Exhaust Nob to ready another Hobbit character you control. So he's kind of like, help me out, the lore one-cost dwarf.
The Erebor Record Keeper.
Bingo. It's kind of like the Erebor Record Keeper from Hobbits.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting one.
Pretty nifty.
Yeah, I like the potential with some of the more specifically gifted Hobbit heroes like Sam. Get another action out of Sam would be pretty great.
Yeah,
that's cool.
It'd definitely be nice to have more of kind of the named Hobbits. Bob and Nob are two candidates, because right now there's the Hobbit deck. You know, I love running Hobbit decks, but it's mostly kind of, it's called a Hobbit deck, but it's basically Hobbit heroes and a bunch of non-Hobbits. But it'll be nice to get to a point eventually where you can run an actual, like, primarily Hobbit deck, including allies.
For sure.
Yeah, I actually tried a deck out this last week that was mostly Hobbits, not just heroes. I think it was created by Chad, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And uses 11 Zs, and it's just a bunch of Hobbit allies and pipes and smoke rings and the whole deal. And it was fun. It got utterly crushed by the Thing in the Depths because the raiders were just basically stomping on all the hobbits, but it's I think in the right quest, particularly in like maybe a four player game where it can kind of get let a Dunedain deck or some other deck take some of the heat, because it's got lots of quest control and cancellation and some tricks and stuff. But that's one of the things about this whole archetype is they're squishy. You know, you really they're not going to be the power. I mean, you can load a bunch of stuff on Sam, but he's still no Aragorn or Boromir. You know?
Yeah. I guess it makes sense. You're probably not going to, if you're trying to take over this enemy ship, you're probably not going to, like, send all the hobbits to board the ship.
That would take a lot of hobbits.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I sent them, but they didn't come back, so.
You were just the heartless bastard who sent the hobbits to the deal.
Send in the hobbits, Captain.
Send in the hobbits. Are you sure? Yeah, we'll just sit here and drink our prancing pony ale and watch.
Yeah, hobbits weren't meant for fighting. I would like to see something revolving around hobbits and being able to throw stuff, because that's kind of like the one, besides, you know, the hobbit cavalry we see at the end of the books, that's kind of the one martial capability that they have, is they're really good at throwing stuff or shooting bows. So there's got to be some way to work in some range shenanigans with that. But anyway, yeah, thank you again, Mark, for sending those in. He had quite a few other ones, which we'll post on the show notes for you guys to enjoy. There's one about the Man in the Moon song. There's one involving Ents and a Greenway bandit. So there's some cool stuff out there. Anything else about these chapters before we crack on here?
Yeah, it's... I mean, we already kind of talked about it, but I do think it's worth highlighting how different Aragorn seems early on, and you realize later, and it's, as Ian mentioned, it's hard to put my mind in that place because I've read the book so many times, but like thinking about the book as though I was a reader with fresh eyes, you would kind of have the suspicion that Sam has, right? Because like, who is this guy and how does he know their business, and they know that they're being spied on, and how do they know he's not a spy? So it's kind of a fun little bit of intrigue in these chapters that you have this guy who, you know, really wants to help them, but they have a skepticism of him, you know, up until the point that they see Gandalf's letter, and then everything kind of becomes clear. But
especially because he carries around a broken sword. Added layer of weirdness.
Yeah, that is an odd thing for someone to do, I suppose.
But intriguing.
So maybe we can end on a little bit of controversy, which is always good. So this is something that stood out to me on this reading that didn't necessarily stand out to me before. And kind of this question of why didn't the Nazgul just attack the inn? I mean, they do later on and break in, but why didn't they just kind of do this full-scale assault? That's kind of a question that gets brought up to Aragorn, to Strider, and he says, "In dark and loneliness, they are strongest. They will not openly attack a house where there are lights and many people." So what do you guys make of that? Does that hold up to you? Like, because on the one hand, the Nazgul seem like they're powerful enough beings that they... I don't know if they're going to be scared of Butterbur and his ilk. Or is it a matter of, like, I feel like even after reading Tolkien a bunch of times, I still don't have a full handle on exactly the powers of the Nazgul, and how much of their power is kind of supernatural. Like, is it something that can be kind of counteracted by something as simple as, like, light and people being around? Or, and how much of it is just an actual kind of, like, physical force? I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
My thought is that the Nazgul are tied so directly to the will of Sauron that they're truly bound to whatever he has purposed them to do in that moment. And so I think my take on this, and as well as kind of them bumbling around in the Shire in the previous chapters, is tied to a few things. One, there is an inherent power, I think, in the shower. The power shower you get every once in a while.
We have our outtake right there. That's perfect.
Inherent power to the Shire, which I think affected the Nazgul. But more importantly, I think that their mission is one of covert secrecy. They're trying to just track down the ring and learn what they can. They didn't even know where the Shire was prior to their leaving Mordor at this point in time, and so they're more like an intelligence gathering mode. And so I think with that in mind, they're kind of in wraith mode. They're lurking in the shadows. They're sowing sorrow and discord and pain. And so by that same notion, they're kind of encased in shadow. And I think that also is interesting if you look at it alongside the goblins. The trolls turn to stone, the goblins hate the sunlight, they're pained by it. Sauron has to spend a day belching crappy smog clouds out of Orodruin to get his armies afield for the Battle of Pelennor. And that's also the point at which the Witch King comes out as a warrior. We've talked about that before. Like that's the point at which the Witch King throws the switch and becomes a super badass, is as he's released from Minas Morgul and he comes to fight at the Pelennor. But even then, there's shadow, there's the clouds. And so I think there is a certain aversion they have to light of any kind. But I think it's amplified in this part of the story because of their orders, if you like, or the will that they're bound to, which is just to find out what's going on and get the ring, but not openly go to war. So on the one hand, that's my take having read and thought about this. On the other hand, it's just a convenient explanation for what's happening at the plot in the moment.
So, I mean, I feel like there's something to that. The other thing that I always have felt, though, about the book is that, so, and he doesn't go into the details on the metaphysics of all of it, but it's clear that Sauron was cast out the last time that he was defeated in the, the Last Alliance, and that he's gathering his strength. And I always took the Nazgul as a kind of a direct manifestation of his power in Middle Earth. So the fact that he's not fully himself yet, it's early enough that he's sending them out because he's desperate to get the ring early rather than have it fall in the hands of someone like Aragorn or Denethor, or these, Theoden, any of these leaders of men or elves for that matter, he would fear, because he knows the power that they could wield with the ring, but which is hence his desperation in sending the Nazgul out and really kind of this almost blundering way that he goes about trying to get the ring, but that the Nazgul aren't really, and I think Gandalf even mentions this later on, and I don't know if we're allowed in the book club to talk about other stuff.
But the only rule about book club is that you don't talk about book club.
I can't separate it in my mind, the stuff that happens later on in the book versus the stuff that we're up to now, so forgive me for getting nonlinear on the narrative here for a second. But essentially, I always took it that the Nazgul are not fully powerful, and they definitely mention also that they're not powerful until they're not as powerful until they're all together. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I took it as, is they're actually worried about trying to do something, not knowing who's in the Prancing Pony, and rightly so, because Aragorn's there, and basically showing Sauron showing too much of his hand too early.
Right. Yeah. That's the big point. Sauron is still trying to keep things close to the vest at this point in time. Dude, that's a good question. What do you think, Ian?
I don't think it's like a gaping plot hole. I think there are reasonable explanations you can make for it. I think what you guys are saying makes sense. I think there seems to be almost like a leveling up when they are swept away and go from being the Nine Riders to riding on their beasts and going into battle. Like you said, though, the Witch King, he goes into his beast mode. So I think that does happen at a certain point. That probably does reflect Sauron becoming stronger. And I don't know. I think there is something in Tolkien throughout his works to be said for these kind of powers that seem intangible and kind of fluffy, like song and friendship and light and just having people around, that these forces are more powerful sometimes than even weapons. And so I think it is conceivable that the Nazgul would be a little bit frightened of that. And I mean, they did have a plan, like wait till they're asleep and stab them. I mean, that's a decent plan.
Solid plan.
That seems decent. And also, as Strider mentions to them, they still have all the long leagues of Eriador before them, before they get to Rivendell. So from their perspective, like, are you going to, charge into this place that's not just the Prancing Pony, but potentially you have the entire population of Bree on you? Or are you just going to try to waylay them out in the wilderness where there's no one around? Yeah, so I guess talking it out, it does make sense that...
Yeah, for sure.
Because, going ham in the middle of this huge settlement is probably not a good strategy.
Yeah, not if your power is in darkness.
Yeah.
I know for myself also, I saw... I'm sure if I get this quite right, but I definitely saw Fellowship. Excuse me. I read Fellowship before I saw the movies, and then I went back and I reread the books. And I think having a stronger visual memory and seeing the movies, not as probably about as many times as I've read the books, I have a hard time detangling them from time to time. And so I know that seeing the Nazgul as they are presented in the movies, they're way meaner and scarier, even at the beginning, and especially towards the end, where you have the images of them on their fell beasts just wrecking stuff, and like soldiers of Gondor cowering in fear. That all kind of gets tied into it. And so, you know, when you say, oh, they would have the entirety of this village on them, my thought is like, well, why would they even care? You know, because they're taking on the armies of Gondor, but then I have to back up and kind of, you know, reframe it within the proper context of the book. So if you're kind of saying the same thing at home, you got to work a little bit to, you know, detangle the films from the books.
And perhaps they were aware that, I don't know, were they aware that Strider was there? That's kind of,
I mean, if they have a problem with light and, you know, those intangible powers like you talked about, I'm sure they had a whiff that somebody important was lurking around.
Because if they knew that, that could also definitely give them pause. Like, this dude is serious. That was one thing we didn't touch on earlier, but it's worth mentioning that he really kind of stresses this idea that he's a hunted man, and that the enemy has tried to lay traps for him before, and kind of the implication that they've tried to put people in front of him that look like their friends. And, you know, I want to hear that story, but I guess we won't. But yeah, that really got my mind jogging when I read that. Like, huh? Like, the Sauron was actively trying to lay traps for him, you know, all this time, and trying to capture him or kill him. So that's interesting to think about.
It just goes to show how much fear Sauron has for the heir of Isildur. Yeah. You know, it's,
and that doesn't really get, that's not made very explicit throughout the rest of the book. There's that mention there, and I think maybe you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it might come up again after he takes the Palantir, or maybe I'm thinking of the movie. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because it can be overlooked, but it is very important to the character of Strider, and also Dan, as you said, with Sauron. Well, we covered a lot of ground here, guys.
Mm-hmm.
I think we changed some lives in the process.
I like to think so.
And we're just doing what we do. Doing it for humanity. All right. Well, let's step away from our book club here for just a second and get to something perhaps equally as exciting. Last episode, we announced the contest. And as a reward for our fine patrons, we have goodies. So last time on the show, we announced that we will be giving away a copy of last year's Fellowship event pack, which is the Murder and Bree quest, along with a very fancy playmat. We felt that it was appropriate to send out the Bree pack when we got there in the story. So, you know, even though I think Murder and Bree is set kind of in the interim after the hobbits leave and people start stabbing each other in clue-like fashion, we're still there now. We've been talking about it. So we've used a proper random generator to pick out our random lucky patron, and the winner is, and Ian's gonna insert a drum roll here during editing or keep my voice in, because that would be just as funny. Rainer Winstall, you are our lucky winner, and you will be contacted by Crabine shortly, so keep your windows open and expect some birds to fly in. Congratulations, sir. If you have not played this quest, you're going to love it. All right, gentlemen, anything else before we put a bow on this one? I will take that as my cue to go to the closing. This has been episode 42 of the Great Company Podcast, brought to you by our patrons. If you like what we do on the show and want to support our contests, hosting fees, and so on, please head to patreon.com/grayco to sign up. Special thanks to Aston, our latest to join the Hobbitry in Arms. As always, you can get in touch with us through our website at graycompanypodcast.com. From there, you can connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, Twitch, and so on. Please send your emails to thegraycompanypodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to read your questions and comments and custom cards on the air. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, good night.
Good night.
Good night.
intro voice ready here. Do we have any really good sexual innuendos in this one? Or is this
they left on the left under the arch. There was a large doorway.
A fat white pony reared up on its hind legs.
Play some fat Al Green in the background.
Yeah, totally be like Barry White.
Okay, here we go.